it's kind of cool to, wherever you are in your life, to start to actually like yourself instead of finding fault with all these things of like, you know, you also have to be open to, all right, there's some stuff I need to change. We all do. Hey, this is actually a good thing. Why don't I use it for good and temper it? That drive, when used for good, it gets them to places that it doesn't get other people. You know, these are superpowers for people. How do you want to play it out? Redefine it, rework it, and make it yours. For someone to drive that hard, there's something else there, but it is a superpower. So use it.
Welcome to Successful with ADHD. I'm Brooke Schnittman. Let's get started. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Successful with ADHD podcast. Today, I have Dr. Evelyn Higgins, and we're going to be talking about biology's role in ADHD, including epigenetics, the very controversial topic about how ADHD starts, how it exists, how it's created, the neuroscience behind ADHD, the behavioral health that goes along with managing ADHD. So if you don't know who Dr. Higgins is, she's the CEO of Pillar Health Systems and founder of Wired Biohealth and Wired Addiction. She's a recognized international expert in the epidemiology of behavioral wellness. She's certified in a lot of different things, including addictionology, from the Diplomat of American College, and also compulsive disorders. She's the Diplomat of the American Board of Disabilities Analysts, specializing in pain management as well. And she's had the honor of advising the U.S. Surgeon General, producing and hosting a Gracie Award-winning National Syndicated Health and Wellness Terrestrial Radio Program and serving as a 1996 Olympic team doctor and Olympic torch bearer. Very warm welcome, Dr. Higgins.
Thank you, Brooke. It's my pleasure.
So you mentioned that DNA changes. We know that. But a lot of researchers, including, you know, celebrity ADHD experts, say that you're born with ADHD. But if DNA is changing over time because of epigenetics and RNA, what does that say in your research of ADHD?
Right. So what changes is the expression of that DNA, right? This is still your DNA. If we looked at those markers again later down the road, we'd see the same markers. But what has changed is how those markers express themselves. And that's where the idea and the power of someone's life can literally change as a result of that is what we want people to understand.
What I've been told by some of my neuroscientist friends is that you're born with the ADHD gene, and then over time, it's either it comes out through life experience or it doesn't. And the same thing with cancer and other genes that you're born with. Is that what the research is showing?
Right. So born with, and then that expression is what changes. So it's environment. You know, if let's say it's an elementary school kid and, you know, everything is really difficult in the school environment, maybe even the home environment is different. Now we're going to see those parts show up. Someone can say, you know, I never saw this in my life. And then at 21, all of a sudden it was there. Well, what happened at 21? Well, I went to college. I was away from home for the first time. Mom and dad weren't telling me what to do. I had a part-time job. I had to manage my studies. I had to figure out money. I had to do all these other things. And those stressors brought out what was always there.
So that changes the genetic makeup, or the DNA expression is changing because of the situation. Okay.
Correct.
So in scientific terms, that's how it's changing. Now, a lot of people will come to coaching and be like, listen, like, I had issues as a child with ADHD, and then I didn't. And now I'm an adult and I'm married with a kid, and all of a sudden it's exacerbated again. Mm-hmm. So are you saying, like, black and white, that the DNA is changing, or it's just life circumstances are changing and you haven't been taught how to manage your ADHD in these life circumstances?
The latter. Right. So what the environment has let that rear its ugly head again. right? So everything that's going on in that individual's life, the stressors that they're now experiencing, are saying, oh, I'm back. Here I am. I was always here, but I went away.
Okay. Gotcha. So is there ever a case where the DNA, you have the ADHD gene, let's say, however, there's no stressor that comes out in your life, so you don't identify as a person with ADHD because you don't see how the symptoms are exacerbating?
That could be. I mean, really, when someone goes for help, it's because those symptoms are showing up, right? So it may be that it never manifested itself symptomatically, always there, just didn't come out in their life. So that's that environmental piece becomes so important to understand, you know, and really what I call the honesty inventory. We've got to be honest with ourselves. What's my environment? What are my stressors? What is my part? What's the parts that I can't change and control? And what am I going to do about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, behavioral assistance with ADHD is so important. Mm-hmm. You know, so often I get asked the question, should I start with medication? Should I start with coaching? Should I start with therapy? What's your opinion on all of that?
So, I mean, because of the work that we do, I always want to see where someone's at in their physiology, right? Because with something like ADHD, ADD also can look like it comes from something else. If someone's extremely anxious, it can look like I can't focus all of a sudden. I have no control. It's because of the anxiety, right? Or because of depression. Those can look like something else. So to me, the starting point is always, let's not guess. Let's see where we are in our physiology. And then let's say, okay, we've got to look at the coaching. If therapy is needed, all the medication, whatever the case may be, all those other parts. But I want to know what's the starting point physiologically for that individual, because we're all different. And you know, in Western medicine, the way we treat people is just the opposite, as if we're all the same. That's the part that makes absolutely no sense.
Right. Even if you have an ADHD diagnosis, you're not going to treat the ADHD the same every single time.
Correct.
It's two different people. Symptoms, I heard somewhere that you could show ADHD in 6,000 different ways. So you're right, to treat someone exactly the same, that's what's the issue is in the first place. We shouldn't all learn the same and be treated the same.
Additionally, Brooke, what if my vocabulary isn't your vocabulary? And I go in and I'm trying to describe all that's going on with me, and I just don't have the words. What does that look like in the end, right? You know, if we don't have objective data, let's see if it's this. Let's try that. When we can go so much faster into zeroing in. Okay, physiologically, we've got to look at this unique biology of this individual. Okay, given that, now start your coaching, your therapy, all the other things that are necessary to have this complete picture working optimally for that individual.
Okay. So for layman's terms, and for me, can you explain what you mean? So I know what physiology means, right? It's the response in your body. But what do you do when you're looking at the physiological response in someone?
So after we get a lab panel on someone, we then look at the biochemical pathways and say, this was the result for this individual. It was less than optimal. It was too much. It was too little. It was whatever the case may be. We then look at those biochemical pathways and say, what do we need to do to support to get to the end result that we need to do, get to, and at to what level for this individual based on what their labs tell us?
Okay. So is it a genetic lab test? What kind of lab test is it?
The SNP portion of things, it's a buccal swab. It's, you know, they're both looking at the individual's DNA. The neurotransmitters, the hormones, urine, saliva, all end products, what's bioavailable in that individual's body. So yeah, it's their unique DNA.
Do you think that if everyone was able to do that type of test and could afford that type of test, because I know it's not cheap, that would be the be all end all of getting an ADHD diagnosis? Like that would be the best type of assessment for ADHD?
I think it would be the best starting point. And I think, you know, hopefully as we continue to progress in how we look at health and how we look at mental health and behavioral health, it is health, you know, so it should be treated like every other aspect of health and not put on the back burner. You know, let's say if someone had cancer in their family, we would say, we want you to get this gene test done. We want to see if that's even within your DNA. You know, it may not be showing itself now, but we want to see if it's there. If it is, we need to know that information. We should get to a point where we treat behavioral health the exact same way.
Right. So when you do the test, what shows for the listeners? I know the hormone levels show, the neurotransmitter. Can you go deeper into that?
So neurotransmitters, we would see, okay, this is where for this gender, for this age, our numbers should be here. Either they are or they're not. Either they're too low, too high. There's clinical correlations to that. We then look at those biochemical pathways. When it comes to those SNPs, so we're looking at either there is no clinical abnormality and there's a pair, right? So it's either a heterozygous, meaning one of the genes is affected. It's a homozygous, meaning both of the genes are affected. And then what are we going to do about that? What can we do to express that differently?
Okay. And so when do you think that a DSM-5 diagnosis should occur, if any?
If any is a good...
because let's face it. I mean, not everyone can afford this. We're talking thousands of dollars, right, for this type of test, and not all insurances cover it. So how do we make healthcare accessible to all, especially for those who don't have the money for this type of assessment?
Sure.
Well, I want to know about ADHD.
Yeah, we are working on some pilot programs to try to get that done. We've had really large insurer come to us, and that says a lot that they came to us. We didn't go to them, and they said, we know that this works, so we want to show the efficacy, because if we can do that, then we can get it covered, and then the other insurance companies will do the same. You know, that's all, that doesn't happen overnight, right? But the fact that there's chatter in that is pretty encouraging.
Yeah. So people are noticing and seeing that there's an importance of being able to access ADHD diagnoses at a price for all.
Yeah. Then at the end of it, regardless of, you know, your belief system of it should be covered, it shouldn't be covered. You know, if you're the insurer and you're just thinking about dollars and cents, you're going to have a lot less to pay out for this individual if their life is working optimally. You know, if that's the only thing, dollars and cents, bottom line, you're going to spend less on this individual if you get them working the best they can work throughout their life.
Understood.
And then to that individual, you know, that's priceless. If you're working optimally all the time, I mean, you're living, your life is the best it can be. It's incredible. It becomes the gift it's supposed to be.
Yeah. So besides behavioral support, how else do you help people manage their ADHD?
On the part that we do, it's really the lab component of it.
The testing.
We refer out to specific coaches, to specific therapists that handle that. And then they understand what it is that we do. So it's kind of like you've got, you know, the teacher's guide going into it of their physiology. You know, you can kind of shortcut insider trading of, here you go, here's what's happening in this person's unique physiology.
Wow. So what would you see in the physiology that would indicate to you that someone needs coaching, or would indicate to you that someone needs medication, or that someone needs a therapist?
Sure. Let's just use the example. Okay. ADHD, ADD, boom, that's what they've got going on. We're going to see phenylethylalanine, that neurotransmitter. not mm-hmm. working correctly. We're going to say, okay, we're going to support it this way. We're going to start out by using biosynthesis precursors because each one of those biochemical pathways has a way that it works. Mm-hmm. If the next level of that is from the work that we do, okay, 9.9 out of 10 times, once we're supporting it the way we do, we don't have to get to the pharmaceutical parts. Sometimes we do. Most of the time we don't, because if your body starts saying, this is what I needed to work correctly, and now I have it, I'm now mm-hmm. seeing how to make this correct levels, right? Also within, I've mentioned already, within ADD, ADHD cases, oftentimes we see markers of norepinephrine, epinephrine, dopamine, serotonin, mm-hmm. right? 1, 2, 3, 4 of those. And we support those too, because it's all of it. Right. Our body always wants to remain in what we call homeostasis or balance. So we've got to address all of those parts of it. And when we are, and we then get out of the way, all of a sudden your body says, whoa, I get it. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
So are you saying that through the behavioral treatments and perhaps vitamins and supplements, that someone can fire with their neurotransmitters to a way of homeostasis like a neurotypical person?
Most of the time, yes.
Wow.
Yep. Most of the
time. And how long does it take for you to usually see that when you refer out?
Depending case by case, but when we work with someone, we do a 6-month plan. And for most people, by that 6 months, they're good. And they symptomatically, they start feeling different very early. Like within a week, 2 weeks, it's like, whoa, this feels different. And, because your body is starting to work the way it's supposed to. But we work with someone over a 6-month period of time. For extreme chronic cases, they've been going on for decades. You know, it could take that individual longer.
Do you ever say, okay, this person's ADHD is so extreme that even though we've tried the behavioral support, I think it's time we supplement him or her or them with medication?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So we touched very briefly in the intro about all of your backgrounds, and you support people and you have doctorates and certifications in addiction and compulsive disorders. Can you explain the connection between addiction and ADHD?
Sure. First off, I would say when I talk to someone a good 8 out of 10 times, when I'll say, did you ever have any diagnoses early in your life? It'll be ADD, ADHD. And really wasn't treated correctly. And addiction starts for one of three reasons: a diagnosed condition not being treated properly, an undiagnosed condition, a trauma that was never addressed. And that individual starts to self-medicate, not even realizing that's what they're doing. Mm. And, kids as young as 10, 11, 12 years old, I started drinking, or I started whatever the behavior is. Older people, when they are old enough to go to casinos, I started gambling, and boom, I found what made me feel good. I was like, this is it. Eureka, I found it. And it's that self-medicating. And when you find what makes you feel good, you think this is it, right? And it works initially because you feel better for that little period of time, but it works until it doesn't work. And then that becomes your next problem. But it's always when you have to reach outside of yourself to bring something in to feel better, that's when we have to ask ourselves, what's going on with me? Right? Why do I have to go right outside of myself to come in here
to feel good?
Yeah. Yeah. So that self-medicating is always the path of what happens. And it's whatever you find at whatever age.
Right. So it's not necessarily drugs and alcohol. It's food. It's sugar.
Right. It's food. It's sugar. It's porn. it's sex, it's shopping, it's all of those things that then have negative consequences in your life as a result of not being able to stop them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's so real, so real.
Ugh.
Would you say the opposite? So many people who you meet who had trouble with addiction have ADHD. Would you say that it's also the same way? Like many people who you diagnose with ADHD have addiction issues.
Yes. Yeah. Because it's just that stimulation seeking, it's that impulse, it's that risk, it's all of those things that are showing up constantly, not being addressed, that then creates the behavior.
Sure. So Dr. Russell Barclay had shared some information about when an individual with ADHD takes medication, they very often can save 13 years of their life that from addiction mm-hmm. and impulsivity and mm-hmm. all the things, all the negative consequences of unmanaged ADHD can take off of your life.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. The behavior has to change. You know, so how do we get to that? We start with, as I said, like, okay, let's go the most conservative route, looking at the biochemical pathways. Here's the biosynthesis precursor. This is the precursor to get to the next step. This is the precursor to get to the next step. We do all that. If we're still not there, go to the medication route. The impulse control, what's happening in that individual's mind has to change. Right. If it doesn't, it's a train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever it takes to get to that point, I definitely agree. Like I said, there's oftentimes co-occurring. There's something more than the ADD, ADHD itself. There may be anxiety. There may be depression. There may be OCD. There may be all these other things. And we've got to address all of them. Rarely is there just a single situation going on. Back to that homeostasis word, your body's always trying to go into homeostasis. So it's going to keep on balancing and juggling. I'll take from here to keep this going. I'll take from here to have that going until one day it's like, you know, there's nothing left for you to take from anymore. But the body's always going to be trying to do that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. When someone's taking a genetic test with you and doing all of the, you know, swab, urine, mm-hmm. fecal, all of that, is there a differentiator that you see between the markers with trauma and ADHD?
Good question. Trauma is more than just a word to quantify an experience. It changes our physiology. And oftentimes there are traumas in someone's life before the ADHD is diagnosed. And again, it goes back to the body starts borrowing from all these other places because it's trying to compensate. And we do that over time and we wind up with our next problem. Yeah. Yeah. So the trauma, it's more than just a word, you know, it's a real physiological change in an individual's body that has to be addressed because if it's mm-hmm. not, it's just going to continue to deplete those areas that it's depleting.
So is there a trauma gene that someone's born with?
No, not a trauma gene. It's more of that experience and how it changes. First off, cortisol levels, our stress hormone, we're going to see changes there. Initially, it's going to spike up because it has to deal with the stress. If that stress goes on for so long and it doesn't change and it becomes chronic, it's eventually going to deplete our bodies from cortisol. Our adrenal glands aren't going to be able to make it adequately anymore. That creates a whole cascade of events when we've changed the endocrine system and disrupted that. Now, mm-hmm. you know, this cascade just continues and continues.
So if you're trying to diagnose someone, and I know that the word trauma is not in the DSM-5. If you're trying to diagnose someone with ADHD, but you notice that their experience has been a lot of traumatic events that have changed their physiology. Thank you. Which one do you work on? How do you know what's ADHD and what's trauma when you're looking at the tests?
Yeah, you're really working on both because they go hand in hand, right? It's not isolated. And that's the holistic approach to treating someone, where you're looking at everything. You're not looking at little isolated pieces, because that's not how our bodies work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We know that there's now identified as the NEI super system, the nervous system, the endocrine system, the immunological system, all work in concert. Like, immunological? Well, how can that be? Look at when someone, it becomes inflamed, a brain on fire. What does that do to the way your brain operates, right? So all of this, it can't just be little pieces. And that goes back to the problem with what we're doing in Western medicine. We just want to treat everybody as a specialist, treat little pieces, and we don't look at the whole person, and we're missing. We're missing mm-hmm. so much. And that person could probably find relief so much faster if we looked at the whole picture, like you just saying, you know, is there any trauma in the individual's life?
Have you noticed in your work that, and I know this is a strong word and it's controversial, but everyone who has ADHD has experienced some form of trauma? It doesn't have to be a big T, it could be a small T.
Sure. Yeah. And that's a great way to say it, right? There's big T's, there's little T's in life, and we've all experienced them. And then it's how we process that experience, right? What's a big T for me may be a little T for you, or vice versa. But it's what it does to your unique physiology, not the next patient. It's what did it do to you, right? So Yeah.
What do you think about brain scans, SPECT scans, and ADHD diagnoses?
Sure. I think SPECT scans are good. They tell us the operating areas of the brain. My thing is, so from that, how is it going to tell us to then treat, or what are we going to recommend as a result of that? We can identify, but then what do we do?
Gotcha. So you can receive a diagnosis, but not necessarily know how to treat the
Correct.
Diagnosis.
Correct.
Okay. And tell me a little bit more about like compulsive disorders and ADHD.
Sure. Compulsive disorders, that impulse control, that risk taking, that aberrant behavior that we talked about in the beginning, it shows up. It's constantly there. And that individual isn't able to just say, shut it down. Yeah, you know, someone else would say, just stop doing it. Well, if they could, they would, because their life is not easier as a result of, you know, doing that behavior. And that compulsivity defining someone's life is so difficult. You know, it's mm-hmm. like with addiction, I'd say no one wakes up one day and says, I can't wait to ruin my life today. You know, it's the same thing with that compulsive behavior. Don't wake up and say, today is the day I'm going to ruin it. I'm going to lose my family, my friends, my job, my home. I'm going to do it all. It doesn't work that way. It's in our physiology and it's not being addressed. And then beyond that, if it's something that's been going on for so long, the way you've operated in your life, okay, now we've got the physiology going. I can't tell you how many times with adults that have been decades of their behavior, they're like, okay, physiologically, I feel different now. I am recognizing, is my desire there to change my behavior? I'm like, very good. Okay, this is where you really have to dig in and start doing the hard work. But to admit, I'm feeling my physiology changed, right? That's a win. That's half of it. Now, you got to change your behavior. Not easy, because your knee-jerk reaction is the same thing that you did yesterday. Although you're saying, I don't really feel like that, but that's what I do. So, you know, it's 3:00. That's what I'm going to go do.
Right. And that's such an important distinction. I'm almost 40. I learned I had ADHD at 35. if I said that everything I was going to, I was treating my undiagnosed ADHD before 35, because of my background in special education and being coached, not knowing I had ADHD. But if I said to myself, for those 35 years that I lived, I'm just going to change everything in 3 months. Like, that's crazy, right? Like, there's, you've lived this way, right, and your brain is encoded,
right,
to think the way that you've always thought and to act the way that you've always thought. So that brings me up to a good point here. You said that usually it's about 6 months where you see like real change, right, behaviorally. You put them on a 6 month plan. Then what?
So either, you know, we get to that 6 months, they've been doing great. They've engaged in coaching, in therapy. They're seeing the changes. You know, what we do is try to be a catch and release program. Like, okay, now you've got to keep on doing your work, right? And if you feel like there's been some changes in your life, something's happened, you had a little T, a big T, and you're feeling that now that you know what it's like to feel good, then you're like, okay, because I know my body now, I know I have changes. Can we do a lab test and see if anything's changed where I'm at? That's somebody that's really understanding how their body works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. And I know the brain can expand and create new neuropathways.
Sure.
And it could also atrophy when you stop using the systems that work for you.
Absolutely.
So I think a distinction too to share is that we have to be lifelong learners and feel that feeling of good. So we have that intrinsic motivation to carry on even on hard days.
Absolutely. Great point. Great point. And so true and so valid. We're evolving every day. Which way do we want to go?
Yeah. Yeah. So you worked with the Olympics in 1996. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you didn't do tests on everyone who was an Olympian.
No.
But based on your, and this is probably against what you do, but based on your observations of what you saw in the Olympians and their symptoms, and I don't know if you did that close of a observation, but would you say that a lot of Olympians have ADHD?
Oh, yeah. That drive, when used for good, you know, it gets them to places that it doesn't get other people. Obviously, the talent has to be there. The hard work has to be there. You know, I'm starting at a point that's a different individual. But to continue that behavior where otherwise someone else would be like, why do you do that? You know, you're out of your mind. Why do you do all those things? Yeah. And that's, you know, I'm sure things that you talk about, Brooke, it's the using your power for good kind of thing. You know, these are superpowers for people. How do you want to play it out? Do you want to give it and make it your superpower? Or you want to say, oh, woe is me. I've got this thing going on, right? Redefine it, rework it, and make it yours. For someone to drive that hard, there's something else there, but it is a superpower. So use it.
I agree. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I get so much heat by saying that ADHD is a superpower, but when you can tune in and you don't even need the financial resources, I'm sorry, it's not white privilege. It's not
right.
Like, tune into yourself, gain support, whether it be a free social media platform, YouTube videos. There's so much good information out there that you don't need to pay for. You just have to differentiate between good and bad.
Yeah.
But use that information to channel your superpowers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why not? Why not? We all have strengths.
Exactly. You know, and it's kind of cool to wherever you are in your life to start to actually like yourself. Instead of finding fault with all these things of like, you know, you also have to be open to, all right, there's some stuff I need to change. We all do. Right.
But sure.
Like, hey, this is actually a good thing. Why don't I use it for good and temper it?
Yes. It's so fascinating. And if you don't mind, I want to just share with you and share with listeners just like a quick little synopsis of my life with undiagnosed ADHD. Not knowing I had ADHD growing up, I had stress, anxiety, low-dose, low-grade depression. and I would see a therapist. And every time I left the therapist office, I felt worse. Every time. And it wasn't that therapy wasn't good for me or wasn't working, but I kept going into the negatives of my unmanaged ADHD, which we thought was anxiety, which I do have anxiety, don't get me wrong. And then once I got coached, not knowing I had ADHD, I received coaching. That was the first time that I actually was like understanding myself and executing and doing things for with intention and like managing it in small steps. And that's when I first felt confident for the first time. So I love how you said, we all have a choice, right? We can talk about all the negatives. We can feel all the negatives. And it's important to know that you have struggles, right? And to recognize them. But also, what are you going to do with those struggles at the same time? How are you going to break free and focus on your strengths?
Correct. And that is a beautiful point, so well portrayed. Because to me, when especially when it's a young child and the parents are like, oh, diagnosis. I'm like, well, phenylethylalanine is low, norepinephrine is low, epinephrine is low. But what are you going to say? I'm like, diagnosis would be this. But I'm like, I'm not sharing that with your child because a child becomes what you tell them they are.
Correct.
And they will live out their life thinking they can't do what other people do. Nothing could be further than the truth. And that really upsets me when people do that, as you could probably see, when people do that to someone else's life.
Yeah.
They are uniquely them. Let's get them to the best them and then let them roll.
So that's a great point. Now, what do you want to tell the people now who are 30, 40, 50, 60 are now learning for the first time that they have ADHD, you know, an auditory processing disorder, whatever, and their parents knew it the whole time? I think you're differentiating a little bit, right? Like, you don't need to give them every single nook and cranny, but like, you can tell them their overall diagnosis.
Yeah. No, exactly. And if they're still in this really bad space and, you know, they've been having some kind of treatment for 30 years, then that was way off, didn't work. Right. It's, you know, knowing like you're going to have to work a little harder at your schoolwork because the first time you read it may not be enough. Right. But that's you. But you're really good at this.
Yes.
So instead of focusing on the, well, you're going to have to work harder here, let's focus on the really good, but be cognizant of here's a reality. And to understand and to teach that individual, everybody's got something. Everybody.
Yes. So, everyone, you know, has something. Treat the individual where they are.
Correct.
And have an even playing field. I used to be in special education. I used to run IEP meetings. I was an assistant director of special education. And these parents, they tried so hard to help their kids. They were very educated. But what I found, and I worked in very good school districts, but what I found is they wanted to just bombard their kids with accommodations and services. And you have to start with the least restrictive environment. I understand that sometimes you know your kid better than the school. And at the same time, not throwing everything at your child at once to see if something sticks, just like in your work, right? You get to be very clear on what it is that you're working with, and then you build on that.
Right.
So you don't treat the wrong symptoms and you don't give the wrong tools and accommodations and wrong support. So then the person feels even worse about themselves. It's very complicated.
It is complicated. But if you optimize what that individual has to work with, you're going to be in a better place of even understanding and receiving that information of, okay, you're going to have to work a little bit harder here. This is your go, don't stop lane, you know?
Yes.
We all do. But then you make it, that's life. And we all do.
Yes.
And that's building resiliency.
Yes.
And we have to have resiliency to get through this life.
Right, Carol Dweck. And literally, like, I know that so many of us with untreated symptoms for so long have such negative thoughts about, you know, the past, right? Like, well, I didn't get the support I needed, so I need everything now.
Right.
So it's like, how does someone deal, right? Like, how do you recommend that someone starts slow and does one thing at a time rather than you know, giving them Roam in a day because they feel so terrible about themselves.
Right. And we always, that's what we do. And we tell people it's because we need to know what's working. If you throw everything at once, how do we identify what was the needle mover? What changed things? Or was it a combination of after we did this and then we did this because of the uniqueness of everyone? So it's one layer at a time and keep building and building.
Yeah. What's the longest it's taken you to create a plan that works for someone?
There are, in a minority of cases, very small. There is people that stay on for lifetime of support, really. That's minority of cases. Most people within that 6 months, they're good.
Yeah.
And then because they now understand what it's like for their body to feel,
they love it, right?
Or their mind, they're like, this is a great feeling.
They want more.
And when I'm not having that, all right, time out. I think, you know, here's what's going on. Should I retest? Do you think I need a little tweak here? What do you think I should do? And then it's that, you know, the easy fix part of things.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to use the word addiction, but it's literally like an addiction to feeling good about yourself rather than feeling terrible about yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, people are like, I don't want to stop this feeling. This is a good feeling. It's like, yeah, and this is how it's supposed to be. But we don't know that. If we've never felt that before, we don't know what that feeling is. And once you feel it, you're like, wow, I can't believe how bad I felt.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of when you're treating, and it's pretty much the same thing, when you're treating an injury, right, in your body, like if you hurt your knee or whatever, and now your knee feels really good or your calf feels really good, but your hamstring all of a sudden hurts or your neck hurts. Well, maybe all those things have been hurting the whole time, but you just haven't targeted other things.
Yeah. It wasn't bad enough.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, Dr. Higgins, this was an awesome conversation. And for people who are ready to dive in and learn more about their physiological makeup. Am I saying that correctly? I think I'm mixing. Okay, physiological makeup. My working memory is not so great. Where can they find you?
Sure. So our website's wiredbiohealth.com, wiredforaddiction.com. Go to either one of those. We have podcasts up on YouTube, Wired Biohealth. Go and watch some of those and start to say, wow, this makes sense. But reach out. We offer a 15-minute complimentary consultation. Just tell us what's going on with you. Is this something that you would benefit by? Is it not? Suggest, you know, this. You know, don't – these things are accessible. Take advantage.
Well, thank you so much for your time. So valuable. You know, the point of Successful with ADHD is to give everyone all of the information for ADHD out there and for them to make their own choices on how to thrive with it. So I know this is going to resonate with someone. Again, I appreciate you being on the Successful with ADHD podcast.
Thank you, Brooke. You do a great job. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Successful with ADHD. I hope it helped you on your journey. And if you need any additional support for you or a loved one with ADHD, feel free to reach out to us at coachingwithbrooke.com and all social media platforms at Coaching with Brooke. And remember, it's Brooke with an E. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.